This is the Confessions of a Recovering Landlord podcast. I'm your host, Jan Gibbons.
And this is Bob Gibbons.
And today we've got a lot of great topics, including the elastic I'm in love with since Thanksgiving.
A little more than that, I'm afraid, my dear.
We had a little more than elastic?
Well, no. A little more than a week since Thanksgiving.
As my mom used to say, Dallas tent and awning is going.
All right. We better get into our real estate talk.
There we go.
Okay, so first on the docket today, what's the status of office? I was interested to see there was a couple of signs of life in the office market this week. NAOP, which is a trade association, it stands for National Association of Industrial and Office Properties. It's really mostly for people that own buildings or, you know, lease buildings on behalf of landlords, and they said that the total net absorption nationwide for office space was 53.5 million square feet. This was their prediction for next year, for 2022. So that's an average of 13.4 million square feet per quarter.
Okay, and just for those listeners who aren't chronic listeners.
Chronic sounds like a disease.
It probably is if you're listening to us. What is the definition of absorption?
It's the net change in occupied square footage. So a million square feet occupied today versus a year from now being 1.2 million, that's 200,000 square feet of positive absorption. So when they say 53.5 million square feet of positive absorption, that just means there'll be more space occupied. And so that's 13.4 million square feet per quarter. But that compares to 8.3 million square feet for the fourth quarter of 2021, which is what they're saying is actually going to be higher by 1.8 million square feet. So all this to say they're projecting higher absorption. But what's interesting about all this is that they're projecting 2023 net absorption to only be 34.3 million. So what
they can't tell you what I'm doing tomorrow.
No.
How are they already projecting in 2023? And I know they have to.
Yeah. Well, it's a way to get their name in the papers. But the thing I think is interesting about this is that they're predicting a big absorption number for 2022 and then scaling that back for 2023. So they're basically saying that there's going to be pent-up demand in 2022 that people haven't yet pulled the trigger on in 2021. And so should be interesting. They also say that while the increase in remote and hybrid work arrangements will probably reduce demand long run, that really hasn't hit yet, and it will probably be offset in the coming years by just employment growth and demand for new office space as a result of employment growth.
The quote I liked in the article was, if you're 21 to 35, you are nuts not to be in the office all the time. Now, this isn't me. This was Morgan Stanley's managing director, Chris O'Day, on a conference call last week.
I wonder how old he is.
Yeah, right. But I do get the point. There are just some things learned by absorption of being in an office, being around a mentor, being around others, seeing how personalities flow together. And so maybe that's part of what they're banking on here.
Well, they're also saying pressure, the informal pressure of coming to the office.
Mm-hmm.
If you want to be visible to your boss, if you want to be visible to other people, you're going to be coming to the office. So,
well, the other thing is with the mandates, that's going to play in here somehow. I mean, clearly it has been primarily with hospitals and government workers. But as this starts to trickle down into everyday business life, I'm going to be curious to see how that works. If I put out a mandate saying all 100 of my employees must be vaxxed, then I'm going to lose 5% of them, and so I won't need the space as much, or I'm going to be hiring new people to replace them.
Yeah, I mean, there's a lot of factors that make it really difficult to predict how much space you're going to need based on the number of people that are going to come into the office or not. So anyway, that was the first bit of potentially good news, although it was just a projection, so who knows. But on the tangible side, the total amount of sublease space declined in the third quarter of 2021. So that's the total square footage available for sublease actually decreased. So I thought that was pretty good. And that ended a seven-quarter run of negative absorption.
But
of increasing square footage of sublease space.
There's a lot of reasons this can happen. And one is because people are going back and occupying their offices. So it's not like someone new came in and took the space. They are just returning to the original space they had and taking it off the sublease market.
To some extent, that may be true. I mean, you're right. The primary driver was were companies agreeing to take on more space from other companies at a steep discount. So that's number one.
Sure.
What you're saying, business removing their space from the sublease market is the number two.
Because they went right back in.
But I mean, that is happening to some extent. They're saying, yeah, never mind. We're not going to sublease. In fact, we have a client who has a sublease space available, has been for the last 18 plus months. And we have somebody who says they're going to sublease it, and we're expecting a letter of intent. I'll be interested to see if the client decides to actually go through with that once that offer comes in, assuming it comes in. So I hope it does. But the other thing that was interesting about this was that the largest declines in sublease space were in Manhattan, San Francisco, both of which have had the highest in the country, Oakland, Austin, and Charleston, of all places.
Yeah, right.
I don't think of Charleston as a big office market, so the fact that even made the list was the part that surprised me. So not too bad, but, you know, sublease inventory, and by the way, this all comes from Cushman & Wakefield's researchers. They said that office inventory decreased in more than 50% of North American cities or markets. That's pretty amazing. You know, if it was just really focused on Manhattan, San Francisco, some of the really large office market, which dwarfs some of the smaller markets, that would have maybe been a little less significant in my mind. But the fact that 50% of the markets showed a decrease of more than 50%, I thought that was significant.
Now, to feed right into that, though.
Well, I mean, to balance it out?
Yeah, balance it out.
Taking the alternate view in this debate. So this one, there's a company called View the Space, VTS, and they have what's called an office demand index. And it ran from 87%, or 87, I don't know, percent's not the right term, whatever their scale is, 87 was the sort of their office demand index in August, and it fell to 72 in September. So that thing fell, and they say the index aggregates data from seven of the largest markets in the U.S., each of which saw individual declines in September. So basically all they're saying is that September showed a slower demand for office space than in August.
But they say that September is often a slower month than August.
Exactly. So who knows? I mean, they're attributing it to the Delta variant. Who knows? I mean, the seven markets they're dealing with are New York, Los Angeles, San Francisco, Chicago, Seattle, Boston, and Washington, D.C. They don't even have Dallas in this. What losers.
Doesn't count. Let's move to the next topic.
Next. The last thing on the office market that kind of caught my attention was WeWork. WeWork, in my opinion, has been a huge factor in the last, 10 years of the office market. They've been a huge...
I thought they only came around in 2015.
No, they were there. They were around before then.
Really?
Yeah. Okay. And so the fact that WeWork has been around and they've made a big impact on the market just because of the amount of space they took on. They had a lot of buzz. I think it was a overblown thing. Almost, I'm not going to call it a Ponzi scheme exactly, because they didn't, you know, get income from one investor to pay off a prior investor.
They were definitely spreading Kool-Aid far and wide.
Yeah, they were trying to get people to drink that Kool-Aid. But nonetheless, they have, during the pandemic, they've gone public.
Can we back that up just a
Well,
tad?
Through a SPAC.
I didn't know that. And when I was reading this, I was like, oh, dang. So they piggybacked. They didn't have what it took to go IPO on their own.
No, that they'd already tried that and failed. But they are publicly traded now. But the thing that was interesting is that during the pandemic, they rolled out two different new products, so to speak. One's called WeWork On Demand, and the other one's called WeWork All Access. And apparently, according to them, these two products are really, really making headway. The first one on demand. Basically, this means that you can just go in and use an office space by the hour, and that starts at $10 an hour. It'll probably vary from one location to the next, or $29 a day. So you can either do that, or you can go to Starbucks for the price of a latte. But if you go to WeWork and you pay them, you can just do that as needed. You don't have to be a member. You don't have to sign up to have a recurring monthly amount. That product has shown an average increase in the Washington, D.C. market anyway of 52% month-over-month increase since launching a year ago. That I thought that was pretty amazing that they really had that much going. The all-access I thought was interesting. That's a monthly membership that allows customers to use any of their spaces and the amenities anywhere in the world.
But it's still just a month-to-month subscription, whereas the other one can be a day-to-day subscription, basically.
Well, true, but the all-access is really intended for their customers who, let's say they have 200 employees, and they're going to have 50 or 100 of those actually in the office all the time, and so they have a physical space that they have for those people, but then they have another 100, 150 people that they don't have come into the office. They work from home or whatever.
They're roving.
And so because of that, those people get this all access pass and they can come into the office anytime. So let's say you have staff meeting every Monday. Mm-hmm. All those people can come in every single Monday as part of their all access pass along with all the people that are already there. But if they're like traveling salesmen or consultants or whatever, they can go to the WeWork anywhere in the world that they want to. Now, these are also, by the way, not dedicated desks. These are in the open WeWork, co-working area. But still, that product has gone up by 60% quarter over quarter. So I thought both of those were pretty strong indications that a lot of companies are taking advantage of the flexibility that co-working and some of these things are offering.
On to industrial.
Okay, that's all we got to say about office?
Yeah, I think so for now. I mean, how much can you say? You're going to go back, you're not going to go back.
Yeah, all right, industrial. So industrial, it's still just blazing hot. What can you say?
Scorching.
It's just crazy.
Thank you, Jeff.
And friends. You know, the thing that's interesting about industrial, and we're just going to talk about Texas here, but Texas has 100 million square feet of new construction of industrial
that's
underway.
1 and 8 zeros.
100 million square feet. And that's in the four largest markets. So that's Dallas-Fort Worth, Houston, Austin, San Antonio. And, I guess El Paso doesn't come into play here because it's really part of New Mexico. But nonetheless, I'm just amazed at how much this is. And of course, this is driven by the influence of e-commerce, continued demographic growth in the U.S., which actually in the last decade, we've added 4.1 million new people, residents in Texas.
And they were all on the Dallas North Tollway yesterday.
Seems that way. But if we kind of break this down, the majority of that 100 million square feet is in Dallas-Fort Worth with 57.4 million square feet underway. Just nuts. That's up 87% from last year.
This time last year.
Of the 19 buildings under construction, there are six of them that have a million square feet in each. So it's huge. And that's just, by the way, that's just down in the Wilmer Hutchins area, far south Dallas, where they just have huge. They have 13.3 million square feet underway, and that's where they have six of the 19 with a million square feet each. So that's a major up-and-comer. Houston comes in second at 20 million square feet under construction. And the
stat I thought was interesting. I'm sorry. You're on Houston. I'm jumping ahead to Austin. Go ahead.
Well, anyway, Houston, they had 18 million square feet of new construction delivered in 2021 so far. So another 20 million square feet underway is amazing. So I'm sorry, you wanted to talk about Austin.
Well, just with Austin, how much they're building, but of what they're building, less than 25% of the more than 10 million square feet of space currently under construction remains available.
75% pre-leased.
75% of 10 million square feet.
For Austin, that's remarkable.
I mean, that's landlocked. Houston at least has a port, and Dallas-Fort Worth is Dallas-Fort Worth. So our intermodal system is better. I guess that has to be somewhat tech-driven. But we're talking industrial, so I don't know if they're using flex space.
Well, I mean, most of the stuff being built is warehouse, not tech, not flex.
Not flex, okay.
I mean, and that's historically been the case throughout the country. There's never, it's kind of weird, there's not a lot of flex space built at any given time. It seems
it's a warehouse that then becomes flex? Or
No. I mean, the difference between flex and warehouse is typically the height of the the clear height of the ceiling, the percentage of the building that's office, and what kind of parking ratio you have. Obviously, the more square footage you have dedicated to office, the more parking you have to have. So you can't easily convert a warehouse to a flex space unless you have the parking to go along with it. And so, if you have 30 to 50% office, you're going to have a parking ratio of 2.5 per 1,000 or more. Whereas if you have a warehouse, it has maybe 2 or less, maybe 1.5. There's some warehouse buildings I see that has 1 parking space per 1,000 square feet. So, if you only have 5 or 10% of
which
the whole,
which is comparable to office.
No.
Office is more like
office
three or four
is a minimum 3 is okay. By code, but most of them are going to have 4 or more. Okay. But in any case, and then coming in last was San Antonio. But even still, San Antonio. They had 9 million square feet of absorption in 2020, and more than half of that was signed in the third quarter. This year, it looks like about 6 million square feet is going to be leased, but they have 10 million square feet under construction. So Austin and San Antonio are tied in that. So
all of it's booming. And last but not least, the supply chain is finally improving. It is being quoted as far less dire than it was in the summer and early fall.
Well, yeah, because, I mean, we're almost to Christmas, so all the stuff's already here, right?
Well, the reason they're saying is because fewer COVID-19-related shutdowns at Asian factories have boosted production levels.
Oh, okay.
And then the end of prime shipping season for holiday is done.
Yeah, okay, that's what I was meant.
So that has
alluding
eased
to.
Demand for shipping containers by a slim margin. But one of the big things I think they're saying is Biden's thing of 24/7, everyone out there working. They think that is part of it.
I'm wondering how much of a part that is, because everybody I've heard talking about that kind of chuckled when they heard the Biden proposal, even though that sounded good, unless you have the truckers running 24/7 as well and everything else, the warehouse workers, that doesn't really accomplish a whole lot. You can't take one thing in the chain, one link in the chain, and change it.
Says part of that could be chalked up to the decision by President Joe Biden and a handful of major retailers, so it wasn't just him,
okay,
to move to round-the-clock operation. One persisting issue is, though, the labor shortage. Well, I can tell you to work 24/7, but if there's only 3 of you and I need 300 of you.
Right.
So at seemingly every point in the logistics networks, from factories in Asia to truck drivers, warehouse workers domestically, just everywhere people are looking to hire, and either people don't want it, they've already gone and found jobs elsewhere. I'm not sure just why there's such a need.
Yeah, it's interesting. I'm listening to an audiobook right now called The Goal, and The Goal is a book that was written about manufacturing, which is not exactly the kind of thing I'm normally going to listen to, but
sounds riveting to me.
Well, it actually is. Whoops, I accidentally hit it right now because I'm looking at it. But the thing that was interesting about it is that it goes through the whole, it's a dramatization of a plant manager who's trying to make his plant more efficient. And when I say efficient, it's interesting because the goal, what is the goal? That's really the whole point. The book's called The Goal, and it's his quest to try and figure out what is the goal. The goal is to make money, not to be efficient. You can be as efficient as you want, but if you're not making money, who cares? And so making money and how to make money and how to line up all the processes that have to go through from sourcing the materials in the first place to how do you use those materials at each stage in the manufacturing process and getting them out the door to customers who want to buy your stuff. Mm-hmm. So it all comes down to sales as well. You know, if you can't make the sale, you don't need anything else. And if you make the sale but you can't deliver, then you're going to fail too. Yeah. So it was a really interesting book to kind of think through all these processes. And even though we're not in manufacturing, we have clients that are, mm-hmm. and we have our own processes that we have to go through. So however you do this, you've got to figure out what are the bottlenecks, how to overcome those bottlenecks, and ultimately you're trying to make everything kind of go through the system at the same pace, if possible, to make sure that you deliver things when you say you're going to deliver them at the price you said you're going to deliver them. And so I'm translating that to this whole supply chain thing, because in this book, they're so focused on the things they can control. But as soon as you start going out into the supply chain, you know, anything that happens before it gets into your plant, the materials, and anything that happens after it leaves your plant is in the supply chain that you have no control over, mm-hmm. or at least little control over. And that complicates things so much. I got to believe these people are just pulling their hair out.
Oh, you know it.
Trying to figure all this out.
And then add it to 24/7. Pull your hair out 24/7.
So is there anything else on the supply chain you want to talk about?
No, that was really it.
Okay, so I wanted to talk about one other thing today, which is estoppels.
Fun and games. Gotta love an estoppel.
I wrote a blog many years ago called Estoppels. Do you need a special cream for that? The answer was no. But an estoppel, first of all, what is it? An estoppel is a legal document sent to you by...
Sent to the tenant by
the buyer of a building or a lender on a building, which basically says, hey, tenant, the landlord told us these are the terms of your lease. We want you to verify that those are in fact true, because they don't want to take the landlord's word for it. I mean, the landlord's trying to either refinance or sell the building. Mm-hmm. So should you believe what they say if they're not going to give you copies of leases and then also verify that with the tenant? So an estoppel is really just that verification process. And so that's why they need it. The reason I'm bringing this up is because we've had quite a few clients just in the last couple of months, even the last month, that have received estoppels. So there's a lot of buildings that are being sold that are being refinanced. And of course, usually when a building is sold, it also is being refinanced at the same time, but not always. Sometimes it's going to be bought with cash, or sometimes it's going to be refinanced but not sold. But in any of those cases, we need to have, there is going to be an estoppel. So the reason I bring it up is because that's happening a lot right now, but it's really, really, really important for tenants when they receive those estoppels to really review them carefully. I would say that 30% of the time, I'm guessing, they're not 100% accurate.
And oftentimes it's not anything major, or so you think, but this includes your security deposit that's being held on file.
Is it the right amount?
You want to make sure that's what you've paid. If you expanded after you had your original lease, you may have had to pay more for a deposit, and that's not recorded in the original lease, so they missed it. I mean, it looks like something small, but you definitely want to go over it with a fine-tooth comb.
Well, and sometimes the dates are inaccurate. Mm-hmm. Sometimes the, like we've had situations where a client was just in the last month, the estoppel made reference to the options they had, which included an expansion option and a renewal option, but it didn't mention the contraction option, which is a option to reduce their space.
Get
space back to the landlord if wanted, or maybe if it doesn't reference a termination option, you know, any of those kinds of things, that could potentially create a problem. Yeah,
you know, I mean, sometimes they'll say, so all the improvements have been done. No, they haven't. We're still working on our punch list, or a lot of things could be left open there, and you don't want to sign off on that, and you've still got sheetrock and bad repair. And
the most egregious example we had recently was a client who we had just expanded them in the building, and we were having a lot of problems with that landlord paying for the improvements, finalizing what the improvements were going to be, because there was a difference of opinion on what was going to be necessary to accommodate another tenant next door from a fire exit compliance issue. They hadn't paid us our commission. I mean, there was just on and on and on a lot of things that were problems, and they hadn't reimbursed the tenant for their construction. And so, you know, we basically used that opportunity when we got that estoppel. We just changed the heck out of this thing to note all that thing.
And we didn't like the way he parted his hair. I mean, we had it down to the...
Certainly didn't like the way he talked to people or ignored people, as the case may be. But nonetheless, the point is that we had this opportunity to make sure we put the buyer and lender on notice. These are all the outstanding problems. So we sent that estoppel back. And by the way, we just did this in handwriting. We just wrote it in by hand, sent it back, and said, here you go. And the buyer and lender were like, hold the phone. Because this tenant, by the time we expanded them, was, I think, almost 50% of the building, or about 50% of the building. So pretty good sized tenant relative to the size of the building. And of course, nobody's going to buy a building or lend on a building when you have that much outstanding problems. It forced the current landlord to finally do the right thing, do what they're obligated to do anyway. And, you know, fortunately, it worked out. Had we not received that estoppel, we might still be fighting with them.
Or if, God forbid, the client had just signed it and returned it.
Oh.
But fortunately, we're in really tight with them, and they, you know, they get a notice in the mail. It comes to us.
Yeah,
and I'm so appreciative.
I get that. I have seen that situation happen where somebody receives the estoppel. They just sign it. You know, because at that point, the landlord is kind of in the final stretch of selling the building, selling their company, whatever. That creates a lot of pressure on them to get it done, because a lot of times the contract to sell the building says, unless we get X percent of our estoppels back, we're not buying, we're not closing. Or they may say, we must get an estoppel back for every tenant above X square footage, and then X percentage of the remainder. And then, you know, it sort of depends on the circumstances. All that can be negotiated as part of the contract. But estoppels are really, really important. And as you pointed out, you know, not just estoppels, but any document that comes from a landlord to a tenant really needs to be scrutinized. And I recommend that it be scrutinized by your tenant rep first. Hopefully that's us, by the way. But you have the tenant rep review it first. And if the tenant rep says, you know, this looks great to me, but, you know, you probably should have your attorney review this as well, do it. Don't quibble over a few hundred dollars to have your attorney review it. It's a legal document. It can make a significant change. And here's the reason why. Let's say you sign that estoppel with those mistakes. The buyer or the lender have relied on your representation that those things are in fact true.
So basically, they become the overriding document of what your lease prior said.
Potentially. It certainly puts it into a situation now where you have a conflict, where the lease says one thing and the estoppel potentially says something different. Which one wins? Well, the estoppel's the most recent document. So if you have two wills, which will gets, you know, believed in a court? Probably, if it was done properly, the last one. So to say, I mean, the lease thing is that it creates a big problem with what is the real thing, what's the truth, what is really the circumstances, and to avoid that, you want to make sure that they're consistent. So anyway,
thanks
all I have
for listening to another episode of the Confessions of a Recovering Landlord podcast, always brought to you by our friends at
Riata Commercial Realty. Riata, real estate advisors and tenant advocates. Get you some.
Where you someone cut his mic. You can reach them at 972-677-028 or texastenantrep.com.
See you next week.
Bye.